The received history of the modern Messianic Jewish movement is that a generation of mostly Protestant Jewish believers realized that they wanted to serve God in a way that honored and preserved their Jewish identity and heritage. However, theological developments in the Roman Catholic Church over the past 60 years may have world-shaking ramifications for Jewish-Christian dialogue and for the future of the Messianic Jewish movement. Our guest today, Rabbi Dr. Mark Kinzer, is here to tell us about how the Catholic Church is embracing distinction theology, Jews and Gentiles worshiping the God of Israel while maintaining their respective identities, roles, and callings.
Put your hand in mine together. We will walk in harmony. Let me introduce you to my teacher, the rabbi from the Galilee.
You're listening to Messiah Podcast, where Jesus is Jewish and that changes everything. Messiah Podcast is a production of First Fruits of Zion. Well, welcome back to Messiah Podcast, Rabbi Dr. Mark Kinzer. How are you doing?
I am doing very well, Jacob.
So for those of our listeners who may not know, we could spend the whole hour here just listing Rabbi Dr. Kinzer's credentials. As you said last time you were here, you founded a lot of organizations. If you've heard of a Messianic Jewish organization, 50-50 chance Dr. Kinzer founded it. You've done so much theological work, and you've done so much work in the congregational Messianic Jewish movement. You know, we value and love all of our guests, but everyone should know that we could just have Dr. Kinzer on every week, and we'd never run out of things to talk about. So we're grateful that you've taken the time to join us this morning.
It's my pleasure, Jacob. I have such a tremendous respect for all the work that you and others in First Fruits of Zion are doing. And so it's really, truly a pleasure for me to be with you.
Thanks for saying so. So this isn't your first time on the podcast. Longtime listeners will remember that you came in season one and you talked about Luke Acts and the persistence of Jewish identity and calling and the significance of the Torah and the land and the people of Israel, mostly in Luke Acts. And you were asked about most of your work, the things you've written. But there was one book that we didn't talk about, I think because we wanted to save it for one episode, because it's worth an entire episode to talk about this book. And that book is Searching Her Own Mystery, Nostra Aetate, the Jewish People and the Identity of the Church. Can you give us a short back cover summary for our listeners who are probably predominantly inheritors of a generally Protestant mindset? How would you describe this book, Searching Her Own Mystery?
Well, in practical terms, the book grew out of conversations that took place in meetings between 2000 and 2015. Between a group of Messianic Jewish leaders and a group of very prominent Catholic leaders. And those Catholic leaders were actually asked to do this by Pope John Paul II. And so it was a high-level conversation. And it was because they took very seriously what God was doing in the Messianic Jewish movement. They, despite our being small in size and not very impressive, this vast institution, and its leaders thought there was something important going on among us. So in those meetings, which took place in Rome and in Jerusalem and with one or two sessions in Vienna over those years at the beginning of the 21st century, I presented a number of theological papers that were aimed at giving a Messianic Jewish take on key theological issues that were of importance to the Catholic world, and trying to show how a Messianic Jewish perspective opened up vistas that many Catholics had not seen. So in 2015, I took a number of these papers that I presented, put them together into a book, wrote an introduction that tried to set a context for this, and wrote another chapter that was telling something of my own story and my own history in relationship to the Catholic world And then also told the story of this conversation that had been initiated by Pope John Paul II, and then included those papers and then some additional material that I added on. And so it's really a paper that, a book that was directed specifically to a Catholic audience. But at the same time, I think it is something that can speak to a broader Christian and Messianic Jewish audience as well, because I think there are insights that the Catholic tradition has that have either been lost or neglected in the rest of the Christian world in reaction to some of the things that were perceived that were very bad in that same tradition.
It seems like that's often what happens when you have a split. Both sides get something good because as they define themselves in opposition to each other, I feel like the same thing happened with Judaism and Christianity.
Yes, that's very, very much the case.
So everyone benefits from reconciliation, which I think is very cool to realize. So to contextualize all of this a little bit for our listeners, I mean, me personally, you know, I grew up in with fundamentalist theology. So I was taught that the Roman Catholic Church was the whore of Babylon. And actually, we had a book in our house called The Woman Rides the Beast, and there was always proving that all of these things. And so I think perhaps some of our listeners were exposed to these ideas and maybe thinking the Catholic Church. Maybe we can rewind the clock a little bit long before 2000, back into the 1960s. But I think before we do that, probably the first question I should ask is, how did you come to know so much about Catholicism and make all these Catholic friends?
Yes. Divine providence, really. I came to know Yeshua when I was 19 years old. And my, you know, my first teacher was a kind of a pioneering figure out of the Hebrew Christian world who had kind of rejected the Hebrew Christian world because it wasn't authentically Jewish. And yet he was not really involved in what was becoming the Messianic Jewish movement in the early 1970s. And so he gave me a very firm grounding in Jewish identity. But then only a few months later, I went back to school. This was the summer of 1971 between my freshman and sophomore years at the University of Michigan. And I was looking for some sort of fellowship, some sort of support for my life in Yeshua. And one of the things that this first Messianic Jewish mentor had told me was I shouldn't become part of a church, because if I became part of a church, yes, 1971, he said, if I became part of a church, I would lose my Jewish identity. I would become assimilated, and that was something that I should avoid at all costs. And so I knew I wasn't going to become just attend a Sunday morning service. And so I was looking for some sort of a group that was different than that. And the group that I found was an interdenominational charismatic community that was one of the founding groups of the Catholic Charismatic Renewal, which of course became this very significant spiritual renewal movement within the Catholic Church. And this was a community that was founded by Roman Catholics. Perhaps two-thirds of its members were Catholics, but a third of its members and of its leaders were largely Protestants, some Eastern Orthodox, and a handful of Messianic Jews.
Wow.
And they met on Sunday afternoons in rented spaces. It wasn't churchy. There was no alien liturgy. And yet it was also not anti-church in any way, because you had people from all of these different sorts of historical Christian communities. So it was kind of strange to me because I didn't know anything about that Christian world, but I felt like, well, there's space here for me to carve out a Jewish identity and to not be absorbed into a particular church tradition. And as a result of that, I was living closely and eventually even just in the household together with Roman Catholics as well as Protestants in this interdenominational type of setting. And I became a leader within this group. I wrote books within this group and was part of it for 20 years of my life, and trying to develop a Messianic Jewish life within that community. That community went through a major split, and that was the point at which we founded our Messianic Jewish congregation in Ann Arbor. And when I entered more fully into the mainstream of the Messianic Jewish world in the early 1990s. But what that meant was I had had 2 decades of experience of immersion in connection with the Catholic world. And it really did mean that I understood it from the inside rather than from the outside, even though I was not a Catholic. So that gives a sense of why I said divine providence. I think I didn't understand in those 20 years what the heck was going on. Why had God done this for me? In some ways, all I wanted to do was be fully in a Jewish context and serving within it. I was frustrated during those 20 years in some ways, and yet I was absolutely convinced that this was God's will for my life during that time. And then lo and behold, it turns out through the strange twists and turns of the way God works in our life, that all of that was preparation for this role that I never could have envisioned for myself.
Wow, that is providential. So let's get to the Catholic Church. And like I said, I think probably the place to start is in the 1960s with the Second Vatican Council. And the reason for that is there seems to have been a major reassessment of ecclesiology. So the identity of the church, what is the church, and what they came up with as far as how to define what is the church went far, far beyond what I think anyone could have expected. And it also provoked a major reassessment of the identity of the Jewish people and the relationship of the church with the Jewish people. I never heard about any of this until, I think, probably until I read your book or around that time. So, and I was just blown away. So maybe if you want to start with, how did it come about that the church felt a need to begin answering some of these questions? What provoked the discussion?
Well, you know, I think the Second World War and the Shoah was clearly the most important factor. There were Catholics who were on both sides of that conflict. There were leading Catholics who were working in opposition to the Nazis. There were also Catholic collaborators. And the figure who became Pope John the 23rd was a figure who during the Second World War was very clearly one of those people who was working against the Nazis and trying to save Jews. He was a key figure in the 1950s when he became Pope in seeking to refashion the Catholic Church's understanding of the Jewish people. And there were many others who were his allies who had had that same kind of experience during the war and in the late 40s and in the 50s afterwards were very reflective about the question, to what extent did our tradition contribute to what happened with the rise of National Socialism? And so there was a kind of stock-taking going on. At the very same time, there were other kinds of reflections about the church itself that were going on. Historically, in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, the tendency when Catholics talked about the church was to talk about the hierarchy. You know, what the church was the Pope and the bishops and the priests and the religious brothers and sisters, those who were part of religious orders. That was the church. And there were many in the middle part of the 20th century in the Catholic world, Catholic scholars and thinkers and religious leaders who felt like this was a distortion of an understanding of the church. And they wanted to go back to earlier sources from the first centuries of the history of the church and from biblical studies. There was a kind of resurgence of biblical study in this period, a kind of back to the sources type of movement within the Catholic world in the middle part of the 20th century. And all of that led to a sense of, you know, the church is not the hierarchy. The church is the people. And the hierarchy is there to serve them. And so this was not something that was developing so much like as a result of reflections about the Jewish people. But what it was like a parallel development, so that at the very same time as the church was rethinking its relationship to the Jewish people on the one side, it was also rethinking its own identity and recognizing that it had to reconfigure its self-understanding. And it just so happened that that reconfigured understanding coincided with the way the Jewish people tended to understand itself, namely as a people. And so what really happened when Pope John the 23rd became Pope, you know, and this was like right at, you know, in the beginning of the early 1960s, end of the 1950s, were these, in him, these two currents really gelled. So what ends up happening is he calls a council, and there hadn't been a church council like this, you know, for almost a century. And in that council, they produced a number of documents that were meant to rethink the very nature of what the church was, with a special focus on the idea of the church as the people of God. And then there was also this rethinking of the ongoing significance of the Jewish people in history, and therefore kind of rethinking of what should the relationship between, on the one end, the church and the Jewish people be.
Wow, like a perfect storm.
Yes. Again, divine providence, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So in your book, you there are two of these documents that emerge as the most significant and most relevant. So there's Lumen Gentium, which do I know enough about Latin roots to guess what it means? Light to the nations?
Light to the nations, exactly.
And then Nostra Aetate, which is?
Our age.
So can we extract the relevant portions, first of all, of Lumen Gentium? Because that one came first. I want to say 1964. That was sort of the opening salvo as far as attempts to concretize some of the ideas that were floating around. So what does Lumen Gentium say about the church and the Jewish people that is so fascinating?
Yes. Well, in some ways, you could think about these two documents that you've identified or isolated as each representing those two currents that I was talking about, with Lumen Gentium really reflecting this maturing sense of defining the church as the people of God rather than as the hierarchy. And then Nostra Aetate as really with the focus on the Jewish people and its role. But there is also reference to the Jewish people in the midst of Lumen Gentium. So as a kind of, as you initiate, as sort of an initial salvo or initial kind of opening up of the topic, which then gets picked up as a centerpiece in Nostra Aetate.
So they sort of work together.
Yeah. And Nostra Aetate is a short document, and it's dealing with the church's relationship to, quote unquote, other religions, whereas Lumen Gentium is a long document, and it's trying to talk about how the church understands itself. And it was really the first time in the history of the Catholic Church there had never been a formal document like this that was trying to lay out a perspective on how the Catholic Church understood what and who the church is. It very much builds upon the central theme of the church as the people of God. And so it when it talks about the hierarchy, it situates it within this broader context of the life of the people, so that it becomes clear that the Pope and the bishops and the priests and the religious orders and all of them, they're servants of this broader reality. They are not the church. And even they even have an in that document a kind of an appendix that's talking about Mary. And it's even like resituating Mary so that Mary is not seen primarily as like just this other mediator figure like Jesus, but that she instead is seen as like a type, a figure embodying the life of the church, representing the life of the church, and kind of functioning sort of like a motherly figure in relationship to the church. But it's like by situating both the hierarchy and Mary in relationship to the church as the people of God, without changing any Catholic teachings, they've changed their shape and the way in which the different pieces get put together, which ultimately changes everything. Because, you know, context so much determines our sense of meaning and significance. Now, as I said, within that document, I view it as a critically important document, but also as one that from our perspective in the 2020s, for me as a Messianic Jew, it has limitations and weaknesses in terms of its understanding of the Jewish people. So that in trying to talk about itself as the people of God, it uses this language of like the new Israel, the, you know, the new people of God, in a way that could imply that, you know, Israel has been superseded, you know, has been replaced. And at the same time, they throw in a paragraph in which they very clearly indicate that that's not fully the case, that the Jewish people are still specially beloved by God. But it's not clear within the document how that goes together with, you know, the rest of the document. And then it's maybe a year later when Nostra Aetate comes out, which is a little clearer here. But still, all of the implications, it takes decades afterwards to unpack.
Wow. So Lumen Gentium tees the ball up, and Nostra Aetate attempts to hit it out of the park, but the ball, we're still not sure where the ball is going to land.
Yeah, exactly.
So Nostra Aetate, and I have read these, and I always feel like I'm missing something when I read official Catholic documents, because it seems to me that there's probably an expectation that you know your catechism and you're just familiar with the terminology, and the context, like you said, determines so much of what we interpret as meaning and significance. So, but what's so outstanding about Nostra Aetate, and how is it this milestone of development in Jewish Christian relations and Christian self-identity and so forth?
Yes. Well, you know, I think for most of the viewers or hearers of this podcast, or people who would be involved in some way within Messianic Jewish circles or the circles of First Fruits of Zion, Nostra Aetate, when you read it, you might say, what's such a big deal about this? I mean, and in fact, you think this really just scratches the surface and it says some good things, but what's the big deal about it? But one needs to appreciate the historical context of these things. And within the Catholic tradition and among many Protestants, there was still a teaching that the Jewish people corporately are guilty, are responsible for killing God.
Yeah.
For killing Jesus, who is God. The technical term for that is deicide, the killing of God. And that was then used, of course, through historically to justify the killing of Jews, because all you're doing is killing those people who had killed God. This may seem bizarre to us, but it was very real. My mother, who was born in 1920, and when she was growing up in the 1920s, she told me a story of how when she came home to her mother in tears because she was told by some kids in school that she had killed somebody. And she said, who did I kill, Mom? You know? And so one of the most important critical things in this document was simply to say the Jewish people corporately cannot be held responsible for the death of Jesus today. Now, again, that might seem obvious to us, and why would anyone have to say something like that? It had to be said. And there are still people today who say those sorts of things in certain anti-Jewish circles, of course, but most of us are not in contact with it. So that was one element that had to be said, especially right after the Holocaust. But the document goes on and goes further than that, much, much further, in talking about the common heritage that Jews and Christians share because of the Bible. And then it goes even further than that by indicating, by stating that, again, that the Jewish people are still beloved by God in a special way. And so without like clearly laying out a whole theology of this, it's a document that's saying there's really something unique here about this particular people, and that God is not done with them, and that they continue to enjoy some kind of relationship with God with that needs to be recognized by the church. Now, when Nostra Aetate was conceived originally, it was originally conceived as a document that was simply going to be about the Jewish people. Pope John the 23rd was very thought this was very important. He was influenced by a French Jewish thinker, historian, Jules Isaac. But the person who he had put in charge of crafting this was a cardinal who entered into close collaboration with Abraham Joshua Heschel. And so Heschel was also involved in this whole process of the crafting of Nostra Aetate. And so originally it was going to be a document about the Jewish people. I think, unfortunately, they decided to expand it so that it became a document about the church's relationship to other religions. And so the way it's four chapters, I think, and ultimately it climaxes in the end with this chapter that's dealing with the Jewish people. And so it can give the impression now, if when you're reading it, that, okay, it's, you know, you've got Islam and you've got, you know, Buddhism and you've got, and now you've got Judaism. But that wasn't how the document was originally conceived. And in reality, that's not how the document has been received post-60s or how it's been treated. It's clearly been understood when people talk about Nostra Aetate, they're almost never talking about the church's relationship to Islam or Buddhism. What they're talking about is that chapter, which is about the Jewish people. So that's something of the historical background. And it was like new for the Catholic Church to come out and say something so strongly positive, both to reject a past history of anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism, and then to say something so positive about God's enduring relationship with the Jewish people. It had ripple effects through the whole Christian world and was a key factor in leading other Christian churches to develop similar kinds of statements.
Yeah, I was going to ask, in 1964, 1965, again, that historical context, it's not like the Catholics were catching up or were the last people to do this. I mean, who else was saying this at that time?
Exactly. There were people who were saying it, individuals and groupings of people, but there weren't whole churches that were doing it. It's really quite remarkable. Since that period of time, the Catholic Church has been really at the absolute forefront of these issues. And it's striking, both in terms of the Jewish people as a whole and in trying to rethink Catholic theology in post-supersessionist ways. It's a process. It's not something that's done deal. But they have a sense of a priority to it. And then that they would be at the forefront, really the only church body that would think that there was something important about Messianic Judaism and begin a serious conversation with us, and that three popes in a row would have that similar kind of conviction. It's really almost a miracle, I think. And something that I think Messianic Jews and Gentile Christians who are sympathetic and concerned about these issues need to kind of to have a sense of respect and recognition that they've been the pioneers, and that whatever we think about other aspects of their theology, recognition needs to be given to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to, you know, you use this term Torah Christology, which is a term that I wish I had come up with. You know, I mean, that sounds like a first fruits of Zion. It sounds like something we'd get in trouble for saying. You know what I mean? But here you're using it, and you talk about this quote from Hans Hermann Henrichs, well, you don't quote him. I think you paraphrase him here, where you say, Jesus is rooted in the life of his people, both genealogically, through descent from David and Abraham, and culturally, through a spiritual formation dependent on a Jewish religious institution, the synagogue. Therefore, the Torah he incarnates cannot be abstracted from the life and history of the particular people to whom it was given. I remember when I first realized that, and I almost fell out of my chair. And of course, this guy realized it years and years and years ago. But you know, just to contrast that with the way that I used to think coming out of Protestantism, which was that the Old Testament was the Old Testament, and Jewish people added a bunch of stuff to it, and Jesus came to get rid of all that and restart a pure religion and all these things. And then I never realized how much of that I carried into my sort of burgeoning messianic Jewish worldview, and to realize, oh, you know, the synagogue means the synagogue, and Judaism is Judaism. It's the whole thing. But Torah Christology, maybe you can unpack that term. What is Torah Christology?
Yes. And this is something that was emphasized a lot by Pope Benedict. And this idea really that we sometimes express in the Messianic Jewish world, that Yeshua is the living Torah. He is like the embodiment. In some ways, it's like a reading of John chapter 1, you know, which speaks about the Logos or the Memra, and seeing Yeshua himself as in his very person, not just like the fulfillment of the Torah, but the Torah itself in flesh. And this, of course, connects up with some traditional Jewish teachings, you know, that a great rabbi who is truly living, you know, as a tzaddik, a righteous person, a saintly person, is meant to be like living Torah, such that, you know, the Torah is not just something that you study as a book. It's something that you actually can touch. And when you want to see what it means to follow the Torah, you need to kind of follow a tzaddik around and watch what the tzaddik does, you know, and that's Torah. That's learning Torah. And so building on those notions, Benedict very much built this idea of that Yeshua himself was this embodiment of the Torah. And then some Catholic thinkers took that, and this I've referred to this one particular one that you mentioned, Henricks, that says yes, and that way in which Yeshua becomes the Torah is something that can't be abstracted or detached from the living existence of the Jewish people, a community, a culture, and that connection is something that endures. And to the point now where there was a wonderful Catholic document in 2015. It's a document called, great title, The Gifts and the Calling of God Are Irrevocable. That's the name of the document. The Gifts and the Calling of God Are Irrevocable. It was a document produced on the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate. It's a document that tells a bit of the story of Nostra Aetate's creation and its impact over the previous 50 years, and then tries to go forward, to take it further, you know. And in the midst of that, it has a section on Yeshua, on Jesus as the Torah, as the living Torah. And then it goes so far as to indicate that when the Jewish people are encountering the Torah, because of the connection that Yeshua establishes with the Torah, Jewish people are, in a sense, encountering Yeshua.
Wow.
Or that could potentially be a way of understanding. It's a little more tentative. They're trying to be very careful in the way in which they state it, but it's clearly moving in that direction. And so that notion of a kind of Torah Christology has an impact, not just in how we understand who Yeshua is, but then how we understand this connection, such that when one is encountering, not only, let me go back. You say Torah Christology means when we encounter Yeshua, we're encountering the Torah. But what is being opened up as a possibility in this document is when we're encountering the Torah, we're encountering Yeshua.
Yeah. Yeah, it must go both ways. I seem to remember, didn't Cunningham make a similar argument in Christ Jesus and the Jewish People Today in the article he wrote, where he says, you know, if we believe in Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and certainly Catholics do, when Abraham encountered God, the Son must have been there because you never have one without the other two. And therefore, you know, that continues to be true as the Jewish people maintain this under the Abrahamic covenant. And when I remember when I first read that, I fell out of my chair because that's just because the ramifications of that are quite clear, that in this sort of hidden way that Yeshua's always been in the midst of the Jewish people before the incarnation and then also after the ascension, whether it's realized or visible or not.
Yes. One of the things I'd wanted to indicate that I think is so important about the way the Catholic Church or many Catholic thinkers approach this is what they're wrestling with continually is how to put together, integrate this new appreciation for the God's enduring covenant with the Jewish people and a very high sense of the person of Yeshua, a sense that you can't bypass Yeshua. And so, you know, particularly within the Protestant world and in some segments of the Catholic world, you know, there a teaching developed that, you know, was kind of a two, sometimes it's called, you know, dual covenant theology, a two ways that the Jewish people have their own special path to God that maybe is through the Torah, as if it's somehow independent of Yeshua, as if the Torah and Yeshua are two ways. And Yeshua is for the Gentiles, and the Torah is the way in which God connects up with the Jewish people. And that is something that the Catholic Church just can't accept, because they are not going to compromise on the absolute centrality of Yeshua and the deity of Yeshua. And so more than any of the other traditions in the Christian world, they take these two realities and they're continually wrestling with how do we put these two together? How can we not sacrifice either for the sake of the other, not lose the sense of God's enduring commitment and love and relationship with the Jewish people and the Jewish tradition, but also with the absolute centrality of Yeshua in all of God's dealings with all of creation. And I think that's what's so unique about the way the Catholics have approached this, and why I think it's so important for us as both Messianic Jews and as Gentiles who have learned from Messianic Judaism to engage with what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And to have the mutual understanding and respect for the rigor that goes into this theologizing. It's not just that we like the conclusions, we can respect the process for sure. So there's another term that you use, which is Israel Christology. And in the section of your book where you introduce that, you have some quotes from Cardinal Lustiger, Jean-Marie Lustiger, which when I first saw it, I thought was a German name for obvious reasons. I had to go learn how to pronounce it because it's French. He says, "Many things can be understood only by recognizing the solidarity of Jesus with those who are his, of the Messiah with his people." And along the same lines, he says, "We must believe that all the suffering of Israel, persecuted by pagans because of his election or because of its election, is a part of the Messiah's suffering." Right? So we have when the Jewish people suffer, the Messiah suffers, and there's this deep identification there of the Messiah with his people, and this almost in the sense that you can't talk about one without the other. You know, do you want to expand on those statements or talk about Cardinal Lustiger a little bit?
Yeah, I would like to talk about Cardinal Lustiger because I think he is perhaps the single most important unifying figure in this entire story. He was too young to be involved in the Second Vatican Council. But in terms of the developments that have occurred since then and its interpretation, and also this whole development of the Catholic engagement with Messianic Jews, Cardinal Lustiger is, I think, the sort of hidden heart of it all. Cardinal Lustiger is Jewish.
Okay.
And he lost his mother at Auschwitz, and he came to believe in Yeshua when he was a teenager, and it was, you know, during the Second World War, and it really came just through his own reading of the Bible. And from the very beginning, he had this strong sense that this figure, Jesus of Nazareth, was central to Jewish identity. He didn't think about it as if he were like leaving Judaism and becoming Christian or Catholic, as if he was leaving one religion and entering into another. He was like this sort of unusual figure who continued to identify strongly as a Jew. And when he was first appointed a bishop by John Paul II, it was kind of controversial. It was controversial both from the Catholic side in France, where they were a little uncomfortable about having this Jewish guy as the bishop. And then from the Jewish community side, it was uncomfortable because he was continually out front with the fact that he was still Jewish.
Yeah.
This was like, wow, we could deal with Jews who simply become Catholics and then leave their Jewish identity behind. But a Jew who's still saying he's Jewish, this is a problem for us. But he ended up becoming a key counselor of Pope John Paul II on Jewish matter, and ultimately became a figure who was appreciated in the Jewish world. One thing I would like to recommend to people is I'd like to recommend that they watch a movie, which is a dramatization of key parts of his life in French that was made by a Jewish filmmaker. It's called The Jewish Cardinal.
Okay.
And it's, I think, a wonderful presentation that will introduce us to this guy, and it's all about his Jewish identity and how he wrestles with it as a Catholic and as a Catholic bishop and a cardinal, and about his relationship to John Paul II. So for Cardinal Lustiger, these were personal existential realities. And so he very much developed in a book that he wrote, that's a collection of meditations on the Gospel of Matthew, that was published, I think, in English by Erdmans. I would highly recommend also, it's short, it's accessible. It's called The Promise. It's a great introduction to his thinking, and many of the quotes that I have in Searching Your Own Mystery from Cardinal Lustiger are from that book. He had a clear sense of, just like Benedict had of Torah Christology, of Yeshua as the embodiment of the Jewish people through history. But not in a way that he replaces the Jewish people, just as he doesn't replace the Torah, but that he establishes this bond with them such that he continues to abide and reside with the life of the Jewish people. I think Cardinal Lustiger's thinking here is critical, and was also critical with his being an advisor on these matters to Pope John Paul II. But then he was also critical for emphasizing the enduring importance of Jewish identity within the life of the church, and that Jews who are within the church need to continue to live as Jews and express their identity as Jews. And at one point, in one of the quotes I have from him in Searching Your Own Mystery, he even argues that the very word Catholic, you know, which means literally universal, but his view is that what real Catholicity means is that the church is a church of Jews and Gentiles. That's the essence of what it means to be Catholic. And that requires in some way that the Jews are actually visibly Jews. And then Cardinal Lustiger was also one of the key figures who was encouraging the development of this Messianic Jewish Roman Catholic dialogue, because he, just as he had a sense of the importance of Jewish Catholics, he saw what was emerging in the Messianic Jewish world as something that was a work of God that needed that the Catholic Church needed to learn from. So Cardinal Lustiger, from my point of view, is really a key figure for this whole story, particularly from the 1970s on into the 21st century.
Yeah. Cardinal Lustiger, man, distinction theology, you know, 50 years before.
Yeah.
These people were ahead of the game, or maybe that was the game.
Yeah. No, there's a prophetic character to, I think, to some of these people and some of these developments.
Yeah, and what it is, you know, I mean, you talk about God's providence. At the same time, the Catholic Church is coming to all these realizations and wrestling with this. Here we have a Jewish people forming Messianic synagogues and returning to, you know, an expression of faith in Yeshua that preserves and guards Jewish identity and that involves fidelity to God's covenants with the Jewish people. And so certainly it makes sense that this dialogue began, even despite, like you said, Messianic Judaism, especially back then. You know, it's in a numbers sense, it's sort of a blip on the radar. But as we've always thought, you know, it's a proleptic, a movement of like prophetic and proleptic importance. It is fascinating that so many and so many influential people in the Catholic Church, as a result of this theologizing that's been going on now for almost 60 years, have been thinking about this and been, you know, talking about it. It's mind-blowing.
It really is. I mean, one of the most beautiful statements about this sense of the importance of the Jewish presence in the life of the body of the Messiah comes in this document I referred to, The Gifts and the Calling of God Are Irrevocable. In this document that came out in 2015, in the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, it's like one line that I really should memorize. I don't have it fully memorized. I really should have it memorized because I think it has that kind of prophetic character to it. What the line goes, it is a qualitative definition of the church, that it is a church of Jews and Gentiles, despite any other impression that is given from the quantitative proportions.
Nice.
I mean, it's saying it's a qualitative definition that the Jewish presence in the church is something absolutely fundamental, that without it, there isn't a church, in other words. And the fact that numerically the number of Jews is not high is sort of irrelevant. I mean, it's irrelevant to the definition. In other words, you can't argue against it simply because there aren't a lot of Jews there. And that's a kind of mind-blowing statement, you know, that I think is so central to a Messianic Jewish identity. I mean, who else is saying these things, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's the Catholic Church. So once they've said it, it's there forever.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you can never take it back.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, we've talked about these theological developments and the dialogue and the talking, and ecclesiology is one of those branches of theology that you expect to be able to look out your window and see it, right? And God is the same no matter what your theology is, but if your ecclesiology, you know, matures, then you're going to expect to be able to see visible changes, you know, concrete changes happening in the world. And I wondered, you seem like you would be the person to know, as you've been involved in this dialogue, do you see the Catholic Church moving toward a practical or visible set of changes to reflect this realization that Jewish identity within the church is absolutely essential?
I do. I see serious conversation going on and participate in some of those conversations in Vatican circles about this question. One of the things we have to realize is that the Catholic Church is this massive institution and community that is found everywhere around the world. And so while the decisions they make at the highest levels and the statements, the theological statements they craft in their official documents, they become like, this is what we teach. But it can take decades or generations for new insights that are found, you know, in those documents to trickle down into local congregations in Africa or in Asia or in America, you know? So it's not the case that every priest in every parish in the United States or Canada or something, you know, has this kind of vision developed. They don't. And so this is something that I think is going to take a long time. But within those Vatican circles where there are these sorts of discussions going on, I think real continued progress is being made. I'm expecting, you know, within a decade that there'll be some kind of public expression of this that we'll all be able to see in terms of something that's some sort of a statement about that is more explicit about the importance of Jewish identity within the life of the church being visibly expressed by Jews. And then after that, it will still take a good while for that to actually sink into and permeate the life, the practical existence of the Catholic Church on the ground in normal parish life. So I'm not expecting those sorts of changes to be implemented and observable in my lifetime. I'm be turning 72 in a couple of months. So I have a sense of the limitations of time, and I am absolutely convinced that this is simply the direction it's going, and that it's simply a matter of patience and perseverance. And you, as someone younger than I, are going to see a set of things that I'm not seeing, and your children and grandchildren are going to be seeing and a lot more.
Wow. There's something to be said for a top-down approach. If you can swing for the fences, you know, we're here peeling off one person at a time and saying, have you considered this? But if that, you know, if that one person's a cardinal, then you've done something that's going to reverberate throughout history, right?
Exactly. I think ultimately what we need are both, we need to be working in the grassroots level, and then we need to be working with leadership. I mean, the kind of things that you do in First Fruits of Zion, I know of priests, Catholic priests, who've been significantly impacted by your work.
Oh, Baruch Hashem.
I was doing some teaching in, I think it was Slovakia, and I met a Slovakian priest who was very much impacted and profoundly impacted by the work of First Fruits of Zion.
Wow.
And I've met another Latin American priest similarly. And the point is simply the kind of work you all are doing is absolutely essential. Anything that normal hearers of this podcast can do in terms of developing relationships with, you know, I mean, we think about that all the time with Christians in general. We have to realize this is, let's not exclude the Catholics from this, you know? Let's try to impact Catholic friends, Catholic neighbors with this sort of vision, because there are things going on in their official teaching that actually map up better to these things than often the official teaching in the other churches, you know? So I see both the need to impact things on this grassroots level to prepare the way for further developments that will also come from leadership, and these things ideally meet and kiss.
Yeah. Good advice. You know, go be friends with everybody and tell them all about what God is doing. And in the case of Catholics, you can point to some of their own theologians and documents. And
yes, exactly.
Theoretically, the path should be easier. The skids have been greased.
Precisely. If any folks are interested in any of these documents, they're all available in English online. If there's a Vatican website, you know, you can access all of these documents, both the Vatican II documents, the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. I mean, if you just Google it, it'll probably take you to the Vatican website and it's right there. You don't have to buy a book or something in order to get exposed to this stuff.
Fantastic. So Zionism has been a big issue lately. It's been in the news quite a bit with everything going on over in Israel. And the Catholic Church is not widely known for its Zionism. So you know, is any progress being made in that respect, or has the reaction to everything that's happened since October 7th impacted your work in any way?
Yeah, I think the only thing I would say, and this is not really so much a result of the recent developments after October 7th, but I think a major development in the Catholic world of the last 10 years, probably, maybe even the last 5 years, is the emergence of Catholic Zionism, or a Catholic form of appreciation for the enduring significance of the land of Israel. And one of the figures who's very much been arguing for this is an English Catholic theologian by the name of Gavin da Costa. And Gavin has become a good friend of mine, and he's someone who, you know, read my book, Jerusalem Crucified, which deals with these issues and which I spoke about in the previous podcast, and was very much impacted by it, and has a similar kind of orientation and that he's embraced. And he's written a number of articles about this question. And one of his most recent books that is dealing with Catholic teaching about the Jewish people since Vatican II has a whole section about the land of Israel and the state of Israel. So this is a new development in the Catholic world, but I think a very significant one, where they're suddenly realizing you can't separate off the Jewish people from the land, that there's an integral connection that has to be recognized.
That's hopeful. That's good news.
And it's, again, yeah, it's another sign of this continual progression or a trajectory, you know, that I think is very promising in terms of the world of Catholic theology.
Wow. Well, I learned a lot today. I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot about what's been going on in the Catholic Church. And gosh, we just appreciate you taking the time to bring us up to speed. And, you know, our hopes and prayers are for your continued success in this incredible dialogue between Messianic Judaism and the Roman Catholic Church.
I greatly appreciate that, Jacob. I do feel like that I've got a few more years here, and this is one of those, one of my goals is to complete a job in relationship to my Catholic friends. So I really would appreciate the prayers of all who are listening or watching this interview for this work, which I believe it's of historic significance.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, again, thanks for your time, Rabbi Dr. Mark Kinzer. Thanks for joining us today on Messiah Podcast. If you're interested in learning more about the Jewish Jesus, check out First Fruits of Zion at ffoz.org. And if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening. Messiah Podcast is made possible by the generosity of our First Fruits of Zion friends. FFOZ friends are people like you who support our mission and get loads of exclusive Bible commentary, teaching, and content. You can join today at ffoz.org. Tune in next time for more great conversations. Until then, I'm Jacob Franzak. Shalom. Let His word cover you and me, like the waters cover the sea. Let His love cover you and me, like the waters cover the sea.